This podcast contains explicit content and is not suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to Always the Last to Know. I'm Ash.
I'm Katie.
What's going on, Katie?
I was scared shitless last night. Mike and I are on a horror movie kick. We watched Talk to Me, which has been on our list of movies to watch. I was so scared that I literally went to hide in my bed.
That is unheard of for you.
I cannot remember the last time I was scared like this about a movie. I really don't think it was ever. The premise of the movie was absolutely brilliant. It didn't really have a happy ending, which I love because I'm so fucking sick of American wrap it all up happy ending movies and shows.
I've never quite understood that when it's supposed to be a scary movie. I think I'd rather the ending just still be scary.
That's always what I want. I don't want a happy ending. It still set it up for a second one, which I believe they're doing a second one, and I can't wait. If you haven't seen it, please watch it. If you have seen it, message me. Let me know what you think. It was a great take on communicating with the dead and possession and a little bit of a social commentary on social media and how people are willing to risk it all for something that doesn't even matter. It was so good.
Okay. I love a little social commentary.
Right? So that's what's up with me. What about you, my friend?
Well, it's Sunday the 21st right now. Yes. And I'm sorry if I sound like shit because I threw up a lot yesterday. To all of my uterus havers, does anyone else get the worst period ever every single time?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's why I got an IUD.
I'm like heavily considering it now because I don't think that I can. I thought about it last night and I was like, this has been 15 plus years of dealing with this. Like, if you ever say that a woman is weak, you can go fuck yourself because.
Yes.
And I don't normally get like, maybe every once in a while I'll get like nauseous with mine, but I don't usually ever physically get sick with mine. And it was hours of nausea and vomiting yesterday. And that was not fun.
Oh, it's the worst.
And then I went to take a hot... Oh, you're sorry. Fine. Is there chaos happening?
Pete just tried to jump onto the dresser and he got like halfway up and was like struggling and then just like plopped down.
Wow. Is this the Lion King right now?
Apparently. Yeah, he just Mufasa'd himself. Okay, sorry. Continue.
I went to take a hot shower last night and like I did. Don't get me wrong. I did. It just wasn't as hot as I would have liked because from my employee appreciation day, I did put on sunblock. We just forgot to reapply. And this is my first year wearing like a bikini in years. And my back is very burned in that one section. And then the tops of my thighs are also badly burned. So just like I sat in the shower and then I was like, okay, this hot water is so hot on my sunburn, but I also like need to be in this. So I just dealt with it. But I was like, this is not great. This is not a great combo.
No, that's rough. Although they say it's really good to take a hot shower when you get sunburned because it opens up your pores and releases something. I don't know if that's real. I've never looked it up because I refuse to take hot showers after I get sunburned because it hurts too much. But allegedly, I've been told that that's really good for your sunburn. Someone once said.
So that's kind of where I am physically. We were going to record this yesterday and then I was like, I'm going to be so honest. I can't do this. I can't do this. Aside from that, we're recording like a whole full week early because next week on Saturday, I'm driving out to Katie's because we're going to see Hosier on a Monday night, which I'm not mad about. I did have to take like
2 days
off from work, but whatever. I'm excited that they moved it up a half hour. It was originally scheduled for 8 p.m. on a Monday, and then they were like, now it's 7:30. And I was like, wow, my 33-year-old self is so happy with that decision. If you want to move it up to 7, I'm also okay with that.
Be totally fine with it. Have this whole show be in the sunlight, actually.
The whole thing. I would love that.
That's fine.
I'm super excited to go to the Airbnb that we have. It's in like the mountains and it's only a 20-minute drive from the venue, which I'm super excited about.
It looks really cute.
I'm so excited. There's so many like little swings and seats outside. This is going to be great. And we get to see Andrew.
Love of my life.
You know, I saw a meme today and I was going to send it to you, but then I was like, oh, wait, I'm about to talk to you in like half an hour. Saw a meme on Instagram that was like, do you ever have that thing that you like became interested in because your bestie's interested in it? And then it like described this whole thing where you're like, you don't really know everything about it, but you also get super hype about it because your bestie loves it. And I was like, the first thing that came to mind was Hozier, because all I had really ever heard was Take Me to Church. And then, you know, you, you happen.
Love my life.
And I remember, I think it was shortly after you, when was this? 2 years ago, when my dad and I drove to Florida, the last hour of the drive, I just played all Hozier songs on Spotify. And my dad was like, is this the same person? I was like, yes, very much so, that angelic voice. Because I was like, well, if we're going to go see him in concert, like I need to know more of the songs because my bestie loves him so much. Now I love him.
And like, how can you not? He stands up for what's right. His music is poetry. Oh, he's amazing. I'm so pumped. I can't wait. I'm so excited to be like on the lawn and get more space. Yes. And just be able to like listen, especially since we've already seen some of like the graphics. Mm-hmm. That's come. It's going to be so good. I'm pumped.
And we get a whole new, I mean, obviously there will still be repeat songs, but we get a whole new set list because he dropped those four EPs.
Right. Oh my God. I know. I can't wait.
Those four songs on an EP. I don't know. I don't know how you're supposed to phrase that.
They're like his little, I think he even said he was like, these are the songs that I couldn't figure out how to conceptually put into the album, but I still very much so love them. So here.
We're like, thank you for that little nugget, sir. Of course. We are obsessed. I take my whiskey.
I'll take meat, whatever you have to give
and
me.
And my coffee black. I'm excited.
I'm too sweet. Oh my God. Yeah. You do take your whiskey neat, your coffee black, and your bed at 3. And I'm like all milk and cream. That's so real. Because you are the woman version of my husband.
Mm-hmm. Hi. That's why we're besties.
Hello. Of course. Well, actually, that's why I married Mike.
You know me first.
I knew you first.
You know, let's get that straight.
Let's make this very clear.
I came first, Mike, and it'll always be that way.
I just love that quote. It's a meme where it's like a best friend talking to her best friend's boyfriend. And she's just like, I know I'm in the wedding no matter what. You might not be.
You might not be the one standing up there, but I will.
I will be there. You 50-50. Who knows? Absolutely.
Oh, fuck. So good. So good. I love Mike.
I'm so glad we got this joyous laughter before this episode.
When you told me to grab tissues, I was like, oh, but I have a whole box.
Yeah.
A whole box. Tell me why there's like shimmer on the tissues, though. And then it gets all over your hand. Is that like lotion?
Maybe. I think I would like it if it weren't tissues. Like, I don't want that all on my nose. But I do love a shimmer.
I love a shimmer. I'm not trying to look like Edward, but.
I might be. I'm still not sure. I might be trying to look like Edward.
Oh my God.
But I don't want it all over my nose. Like I'm snorting glitter cocaine. Like, no,
exactly,
thank you.
What I was thinking. Well, on that note, let's definitely get into what we're going to talk about today, because I have no idea. And apparently you're about to emotionally destroy me.
First, I want to start off with a trigger warning. This episode talks about the completion of suicide, suicidal attempts, sexual assault by family members, drug use, drug overdose, and homophobia. With that being said, this episode actually goes out to a really good friend of mine, like basically family, Alex Martini, who introduced me to today's subject through showing me one of my favorite movies of all time, Factory Girl. Alex has worked on all of your favorite shows and movies. I'm not kidding. She's worked on Project Runway, Glow, Dirty John, Arrested Development, The OA, Booksmart, Birds of Prey, WandaVision, Venom, You, the movie Civil War that just came out, and so many more. Alex's directing debut can actually be seen later this year at various film festivals with a short film, Fall Risk, which stars Victoria Pedretti and Caitlin Stassi. It's about a young woman named Dylan, played by Victoria, who finds herself in and out of hospitals and rehabilitation centers with a life-changing diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. However, as Dylan navigates her new reality, she begins to suspect something is amiss with her partner, Emily, and if her body is the biggest deception in her life, who is she supposed to trust? Alex was like one of the first people who showed me that like films are showing what is beyond just the premise of the movie. We met before high school, but she ended up coming to our high school our sophomore year. She's going to be a huge name in Hollywood. Fall Risk is one of the most incredible short films I've ever seen. And I've seen two different cuts of it. She had to change it for entering it in festivals to meet criteria. And it's amazing. It's incredible.
I can't wait to watch it.
She's actually been picked up by a festival that's happening in LA that you can get tickets for. So if you're out in California, I highly recommend it. Like, this is not a paid ad. She is just so fucking talented and incredible.
We just really love Alex.
I love Teenie so much. She's the most magnetic person I think I've ever met in my life. I'm just so proud of her. So Alex, this one is for you. The life of another magnetic storyteller, a muse that I wouldn't know of if it weren't for you, and a person who has played a huge impact in my life and kind of how I perceive other people. Just because someone is beautiful and seems to have everything going on doesn't mean that they do. This is the story of Edie Sedgwick. Factory Girl is a phenomenal movie, but they changed some parts. So I'm going to be setting the record straight a little bit, which I think is really important. So let's get into it. Edie Sedgwick was born in Santa Barbara, California to like old money parents. Her ancestors were some of the first people to come over and colonize America and were one of the wealthiest families to do so. Her ancestor was actually like close pals and colleagues with the people who signed the Declaration of Independence and like could have been one of those people. Factory Girl says that he was. He wasn't, but he easily could have. He just I basically wasn't around when it happened.
Wait, I need to tell you really quick. The only reason I've seen Factory Girl is because it was Alex Martini's DVD. Okay, just needed to tell you that too.
Yeah, she used to have a DVD library. Edie was born on April 20th, 1943. So she is technically a Taurus, but she is a cusp, a little bit of a cusper, that same period. So some people would talk about how she's an Aries. I couldn't find necessarily anything of her saying what she was, but I bet it's out there. She was the seventh child for her parents, Alice Delano de Forest and Francis Minturn, Duke Sedgwick. Edie was named after her father's favorite aunt, Edith Minturn Stokes. Both of her parents, if you couldn't tell by these names, came from elite families. So her early life was like significant wealth and highborn connections. It was also a life full of eccentricities, dark secrets, and an extensive history of mental illness that, similar to Marilyn Monroe, can be traced back generations. Rich ancestry included Theodore Sedgwick, who was a Speaker of the House under Thomas Jefferson, Ellery Sedgwick, a longtime editor of the Atlantic Monthly, and Ellery's brother, Henry Dwight Sedgwick, who was a prolific popular historian who, quote, knew and didn't particularly like Henry James. So like they're in the books. They're incredibly important. In her book about the family, Alice Sedgwick Wall, Edie's older sister, mentions that they were all brought up, quote, not to talk about anything personal. I am uncomfortably aware that the mere recitation of these facts can amount to bragging, end quote. Like the Kennedys, they were very much so trained on how to be. They weren't told to talk about anything because they came from so much that they were kind of taught how to be humble. Yeah. And their history is so massive and important that they were like, no, we can't really talk about like the important things our family did, which is pretty great. Trying to, you know, humble children, but their parents didn't do great. In order to understand the life that Edie lives, we must first look into the two that created her. I hesitate to say raise, and you're going to find out why. Here's a quote from Vanity Fair. Quote, not caring for daddy, he insisted his kids call him Fuzzy. Though he wasn't. He was a brute son of a bitch, and his sexual arrogance and sense of privilege seemingly without limit. Edie would tell people that she was seven when he made his first deflected pass, end quote.
Whoa!
Right off the bat. They didn't call him dad. They referred to him as Fuzzy, as if they're friends, which is like very much so removing the parental connection and then like sexually hitting on your child.
Yeah. Like every bit of that is intentional.
Yeah. Cedric's father had long struggled with both physical and mental health issues. He was born with an umbilical hernia. And in modern time, this isn't a huge deal, but back then, in his day, it's basically a death sentence. As a child, he developed asthma, as well as almost a fatal bone infection at one point. So he was sickly. It wasn't just his physical health that needed a lot of focus. Francis landed himself in and out of psychiatric units throughout his teen years, receiving a diagnosis for both manic depressive psychosis and nervous breakdowns.
Oh, what a mixture.
Yeah. Because of what they refer to as his delicate health, his dreams of becoming a railroad tycoon. Because, like, that's the time period we're in.
It makes me think of Roller Coaster Tycoon.
Yes. Sorry. I'm just picturing the Monopoly Man.
Oh, yeah. That sounds about right.
Instead of focusing on that and the advice of doctors, he turned to his sculpting talents and became a professional artist. Sedgwick's mother, on all accounts, was, quote, painfully shy and very much in love with Francis, end quote. Alice grew up on Long Island on an estate called Nethermere, which is a 150-acre property that had been in her family since 1866. Wow. And had, like, a complete view of the Long Island Sound.
I bet that's so beautiful.
150 acres. I bet it's fucking gorgeous.
It's, like, crazy because... So rich, so much money, but so also rich. I would love to see that view.
I just want
to
see.
Can I have enough privilege to go see the view?
Please. I actually, you know what? Maybe I'll look into that and we'll talk about that.
Are you allowed to visit the property?
I don't know. I didn't really look into it because I don't know if I want to go to any. But I want to, but I don't want to.
I want to see the island sound the Long Island Sound. There we go. I would love to see the Long Island Sound from that viewpoint. I think that's what I really want, not because it's connected to them.
Absolutely. She, for their entire relationship, was incredibly supportive of Francis, like, mental and physical conditions, and while they were together, she would go and visit him while he was hospitalized. The two had actually met because Duke went to school with Alice's older brother. When they became engaged, the doctors were like, hey, guys, don't have kids because of Francis's
issues. Oh my God. They were like, bet, we're going to do the opposite.
Yeah. Quote, my mother had a difficult time with the births of her last children, but she kept getting pregnant anyway. Alice Saucy was her nickname, Sedgwick, because they all had nicknames.
Oh, that's
very, very Kennedy-like. When Edie was born, she, her mother, nearly died. I have no idea why my mother went on having children when it was so dangerous for her, end quote. Despite Alice's struggles in giving birth to Edie, Francis encouraged his wife to continue expanding the family. According to Saucy, partly because he liked the idea of, quote, producing a spectacular number of children, end quote.
That feels mentally unstable decision to me.
Oh, absolutely. I can't remember. I think it was this podcast called Muses. They brought up an excellent point where they were talking about how it was almost like, because he couldn't be sporty and athletic railroad tycoon, he was like, but look at how virile I am. I've created so many children.
Meanwhile, mama's almost dying during birth. Like, that's crazy.
Right?
You know, to put her through that over and over again.
Just for this. It's wild. Cedric and her siblings didn't remember her father or mother as loving the practical aspects of raising children. So instead, they were handed off to a series of nannies and governesses to be reared during the winters in Cold Spring Harbor on Long Island and the summers at their parents' home in Santa Barbara, which feels so backwards.
It's so cold on Long Island in the wintertime. What?
I don't understand. No sense is being made. It's around the time of Edie's birth that Francis begins to developed a wandering eye, but he actually just, like, begins acting on his wandering eye, quote, begins a string of adulterous affairs, end quote. Saucy goes on to say, "It was at one of my parents' parties. I saw my father disappear into the bushes right in front of my mother with his arm around a woman, just traipsed off into the bushes in front of 50 people," Saucy revealed. "But Alice never batted an eyelash, at least in public. She didn't take her frustrations and anger at my father's affair out on the children," Cedric's brother Jonathan said. "She'd get allergies and needed special diets." AKA, she just spent a lot of her time being too sick to attend things and was like in her room a lot, or just not around. Probably personal, not professional opinion, really depressed.
Probably the way that no one batted an eye at that is really reminding me of everything we talked about in Maryland. Like everyone knew about Charles' affair, but no one did anything because that was the norm. Like everyone had their little affair partner.
Oh, with Diana. Yeah.
Oh, wait, what did I say? Maryland? Sorry, Diana.
But it's a little bit of that too, because a lot of, like, not Arthur Miller, the other one, the baseball player.
Oh, DiMaggio.
DiMaggio had affairs. Like, people just kind of, like, acted like this was the norm. Mm-hmm. And it shouldn't be.
And at least, like, if you want to have relations with another person, like, find a partner who's open to being open. Like, Jesus.
Right? Just communicate. Cedric's parents continued to grow more and more distant from each other, and that continued even after they all moved full-time into a 3,000-acre ranch in California. They purchased this after Fuzzy was rejected from the military because of his failing health. This is like around the World War II. So he wanted to get involved in World War II, but they're like, "You are so sick, bro." They bought the ranch and he was like, "I'm going to raise cattle here in order to support the efforts of the war." Once they settled onto the ranch, Cedric's father began to behave very strangely, quote, distancing himself from the family, becoming icy and remote, while their mother became cautious and reserved, end quote. This move really, really, really threw a huge wrench into the family. As the kids are growing up on this ranch, they are incredibly isolated from the outside world. They don't have other friends. They don't go to school. They're homeschooled on the ranch. They don't talk to other people. They just have like their maids and stuff who take care of them, and then Fuzzy and their mom who come around sometimes. That's not a great environment to raise children in.
This is not conducive to a good childhood.
That is exactly the phrase that I was looking for. Thank you. Her and her sisters, Kate and Sookie, were housed separately from their parents with their nurse, Addie, where they were dressed in hand-me-downs, even though they're very, very wealthy, and taught to ride horses as early as 18 months of age.
Whoa. That feels very young to be on a horse, and I love horses.
I'm assuming they're not alone.
There's no way. There's no way.
Like, there must be some sort of like way to like cradle them. I don't know. I don't know why I'm defending their parents.
I could imagine that there's a way to strap an 18-month-old into a horse. I'm just like so concerned about all of that bouncing around and the baby's brain in its skull. I think that's what my concern is.
That's a great point to keep in mind. That being said, these kids are allowed to just run wild on, again, their 3,000-acre ranch. Crazy. Without, like, they would just disappear 4 hours without any adult supervision from sunrise to whenever, and just playing whatever they want. Like, kind of a child's dream.
Child Ashley would have been so into that, but that's also, like, incredibly isolating and dangerous.
So it's a little bit of, like, a Chronicles of Narnia situation, because they would be able to, like, go and have these amazing adventures, but once they would come back into the house, they're under the oppressive rules of this, like, elite East Coast old money society that they had come from. So it's, like, almost to their benefit to just stay out of the fucking house. And it's not like they're getting parental care or love or even their own sense of self with, like, clothing. Like, I think it's very weird that they would only have hand-me-downs for so many children when they're so wealthy. And at some point, they end up finding oil on this ranch, and they move to a bigger ranch.
So they're now even wealthier.
Yeah, they get even wealthier, which kind of becomes really important for Fuzzy, because he didn't have any money. All of the money really came from Alice's family estate. So he didn't really have his own source of wealth the way that she did. So when they found this oil, he got to be like, well, this is my money. And that didn't do great things for his mental health. The Sedgwick children were educated in a private school that they constructed on the ranch. So they built a little school for them. This is a little commune. And, quote, taught a curriculum endorsed by their father.
Oh.
Ding, ding, ding. There's the problem.
There's the red flag.
Quote, we were taught in a weird way, so that when we got out into the world, we didn't fit in anywhere. Nobody could understand us, end quote, said Sedgwick's brother, Jonathan, who would later admit, we learned English in the way the English do, not Americans. Which is like a weird thing to do to kids in America. Through this isolation, the parents' issues, the tension in the house was fucking unbearable. And all of the children, quote, began turning inward. Suki would later recall how the isolated life of the ranch began taking a toll on Sedgwick as a small child. Edie would be turmoiling over some useless and absolutely nonsensical detail, Suki later recalled. I began to realize that Edie had times when she wasn't totally herself. She couldn't escape from it either. I knew it wasn't her fault, but I didn't know what the hell it was. Edie would later admit that her father had pressured her sexually at an early age, claiming that he attempted to sleep with her from the age of about 7 on. She also said that one of her brothers had insisted that, quote, a sister and brother should teach each other the rules and the game of making love. She wouldn't fall for that either, end quote. So that's her childhood, completely isolated from the rest of the world, only learning the education that Fuzzy wants her to learn, but in such a way that's going to keep her isolated from everything. She has no control of her life. And then as a teenager, she walks in on Frances having sex with a woman who wasn't her mother.
Whoa.
And she kind of freaks out, understandably. He hits her and says, you didn't see what you saw. You don't know anything. You're insane, is what he said to her. And then immediately had a doctor administer a wild amount of tranquilizers.
Wow. The gaslighting, the trauma.
After that, she was sent to Silver Hill, which is a psychiatric hospital in Connecticut.
Damn it. All right. As soon as you started to say administer, I was so nervous that the next thing out of your mouth was like, we're putting her into a facility. And then you just hit me with that. Like, I knew that was coming. He had to get her out of the house so that she couldn't talk. Oh my God.
And the thing that's like so wild is that like Alice already knows about the affairs.
So like, why are you doing this?
So why do this?
Because he's mentally unstable.
And consistently trying to have sex with her. Edie is dealing with all of this stuff and her lack of control in her life. She's coping with these pressures through anorexia and bulimia. She has developed an extreme eating disorder at 13. After Silver Hill, she goes to a prestigious boarding school. She is quickly sent back home once her teachers realize not only that she has an eating disorder, but just how severe it is.
Yeah.
They're like, we are not equipped to handle this.
It's also kind of shitty because then they're like literally sending her back to the source of the trauma that has caused this.
And it's a bummer because she was doing well there. She was like making friends. She was riding horses. She was taking ballet. People are interviewed from that boarding school for one of the books that I read. And like they all had like really great, sweet things to say about her. But because of these issues at the school, which is like, we can't help her with this. You guys need to send her somewhere that they can. So she goes back home. And this return back home is, in my notes, I wrote particularly destructive. It is abuse and torture. Her father has her locked in her room, forcing her to stay heavily medicated and on bed rest. While she's doing that, her mom begins like babying her. And like kind of like talking to her like she's a baby. Several of her siblings recount Sedgwick's almost regression into infancy, noticing that she starts talking like a baby back. Mm-hmm. and doing sort of like childlike play at 13, 14.
I was worried that that's what you were going to say was happening, the regression, because of her mom talking to her like that.
Yeah. And this really stood out to me, this quote from her brother, Jonathan. Quote, "She lost all her feelings because everything around her was an act now. She knew what had really happened, and my father just denied the whole thing and that it really hurt her. They're drugging her up, pretending that she didn't walk in on her dad having sex. The only thing that I can genuinely equate it to, and this is part of the reason, and this feels so silly, but this is part of the reason that rewatching Pretty Little Liars fucked me up, because I was doing my research while the girls were kidnapped and put into the dollhouse. What was the difference there between what was happening to Edie and what was being depicted on that show? She was essentially kidnapped by her parents, drugged, forced into bed rest and locked in her room, and then treated like a baby and like spoken to like, oh, little Edie. Like, I can't. It's psychological torture. After this, in 1958, Cedric gets shipped off to another boarding school, St. Timothy's in Maryland. Her stay here lasted a year before her parents really noticed that her mental and physical health was slipping again. At her father's insistence, I hate even call at Fuzzy's insistence, she was sent to Silver Hill again in 1962, which this is, I want to say, is more like a country club than a hospital. Mm. It's like a treatment facility for the wealthy elite. And her brother was there and spent time there. So being sent to Silver Hill at these times weren't super traumatic. Well, let's not say that. It's not what I'm going to describe later that she deals with. That being said, while she's there, her condition worsens. She drops to 90 pounds. That's when she's sent to the closed ward of Bloomingdale, the Westchester Division of New York Hospital. Quote, "When I was in the hospital, I was very suicidal in kind of a blind way," Cedric later said of her time in Bloomingdale. "I didn't want to turn out like my family showed me. I wasn't allowed to associate with anyone. So I didn't want to live." Regardless of this feeling, it's in this closed, controlled environment that Edie's able to get real help and begin to thrive. She starts building trust with the people there and gaining the ability to leave the hospital on her own to like attend classes and pursue interests and then come back. At one point, she loses her virginity to a Harvard student and becomes pregnant from this encounter. Some say that sources decided to have an abortion. Others say that it was a choice that the hospital made, citing her psychological issues as a reason to not have the child. Either way, an abortion happened, and she left Bloomingdale shortly after to study at Cambridge in 1963.
Wow. The jump of going from a facility.
Facility to facility.
Facility to facility, like becoming pregnant, having an abortion, and then going to Cambridge, like right from that. That's wild. Are you good to go study? Because I don't think you are, and I'm concerned.
But also, like, you can't go home.
Oh my God. Not there. Anywhere but there.
So she went to study art.
Okay, good.
It's not, you know, she's not studying like law or something that would potentially be incredibly stressful. During this time, her older brother, Minty, was also bouncing in and out of psychiatric wards with his own issues. In 1964, a day before his 26th birthday, Minty hangs himself. It was later revealed that Minty had confessed that he was gay to Fuzzy, and Fuzzy then attempted to force him into being straight. And Minty chose to complete suicide rather than deal with the life he saw in front of him. To say that Edie was devastated by this loss doesn't even come close to the emotions that she felt. She held on to this loss for the rest of her life and was very upfront that she held Fuzzy accountable for what happened to Minty.
He was absolutely responsible for that.
Regardless of this anger that she felt towards him, when he demanded that she come home for Christmas and that her brother Bobby, who is out in Cambridge with her, does not, she felt as though she had no choice but to obey. Fuzzy is paying for things, and she was terrified of Fuzzy having her committed again. It was the biggest fear throughout her whole life, was being committed the way that she was. She would only continue to experience more heartbreak because when she went home for Christmas, her brother Bobby suffered a nervous breakdown. His mental health would gradually deteriorate until he slammed his bike into a New York City bus on New Year's Eve. He died on January 12th, 1965, and he was only 31 years old at the time of his death. For her entire life, she held on to the notion that he did this on purpose, that both of her brothers had committed suicide because of their dad, because of Fuzzy. Neither of the boys were given funerals. But years later, we're told by Fuzzy that he spread their ashes at the ranch. We don't know if that's true or not, but he claimed
that he did. That makes me very, very upset because that place was such a source of trauma for them. How dare you? How dare you?
And not involve your siblings. That's really fucked up. Edie moved to New York in 1964 when she was living with her maternal grandmother. Shortly after moving there, when her grandmother passed, she received an $80,000 trust fund from her, which would be just under $1 million today. So she had, I don't want to say a cushion because it's more than that. She didn't need to worry. Fuzzy's still giving her an allowance from their money, but she has this to hold on to. With aspirations of becoming a model, she picks up dance again and starts taking classes. She's trying out for more modeling gigs and she's attending like high society events. And while she's doing that, everyone is drawn to her everywhere. She walks into a room and all eyes are on her. By fall, she moves out on her own to a place on East 64th Street, which her parents furnished, and she spent nearly every night partying with her Harvard friends who had followed her down to New York City. She is rapidly becoming a very well-known name. She's beautiful, she's rich, she's incredibly generous with her money, and she's just an intoxicating personality. It's 1964 when Bob Dylan and his right-hand man, Bob Newworth, kind of catch word of this incredible woman, Edie, and quote, just had to meet her. The Bobs are a complicated but very important part of this story. So I just needed to throw in when they catch word of her. She gets into a car accident. Actually, this is really weird. While she's out in California, she gets into a car accident at the same time that Bobby got into his accident.
Oh, that's crazy.
She breaks her leg and she has a cast on and she's like severely injured, but she basically busts out of the hospital to return to New York and like return to her party scene. And Newirth talks about when he saw her, like the first time he saw her at a party, she's sitting there with her giant cast on and has a sculptor who's there come over and chisel her leg cast off of her. And then sends out like a flurry of her pals to grab a bunch of wire hangers that she uses her scarves to turn into a splint so that she can just spend the rest of the night dancing.
Oh my God.
Bob Newirth says her doctor told her she was going to be a cripple and she was determined to prove him wrong. End quote.
Damn.
She's like, let me just get this cast off. I need to dance.
I feel that girl.
Totally get it. During this time, Edie begins a romantic relationship with Newirth, who she would later refer to as the love of her life. In Factory Girl, they really make it seem like that's Bob Dylan. Mm. And we will get into her rumored relationship with him later. Words of her own mouth, Bob Newirth was the love of her life. And he is a huge source of support for her later in life. And I really wish that they had done that love better in the movie because they kind of just make him look like a little nerd. Yeah. Who's following her around, and that's so not the case at all. She has a quote about him where she's like, I learned everything about sex, we made love for hours. Ooh. Like, she loved him. Her friend from Cambridge, Chuck Wine, who sort of became what we would call now her manager, is setting her up to like meet people. He's managing her day to day, and he kind of aligns her up to attend a party for Tennessee Williams. Yes, that one. On March 26, 1965, she attends his birthday party and Andy Warhol is also there. Andy recalls about their initial encounter, quote, I could see that she had more problems than anybody I'd ever met. So beautiful, but so sick. I was really intrigued.
Oh, that's so fucked up.
That quote completely encapsulates their entire relationship.
If that's not literally Andy Warhol's entire vibe. Yeah.
Yeah. Andy Warhol quickly invites Edie and Chuck to meet him the next day at the infamous studio, The Factory. Truman Capote states, "I think Edie was something that Andy would have liked to have been. He was transposing himself into her a la Pygmalion. Andy would have liked to be Edie Sedgwick. He would have loved to have been a charming debutante from Boston." Mm. And that is where part one will end.
Oh, okay.
The beginning of Edie Sedgwick's life. Next week, we're going to get into The Factory, the start of their relationship, and the downfall of their relationship, which is so much quicker than Factory Girl makes it seem like. They meet in March and they're not friends by like July, August.
Yeah, the movie makes it seem like it's like years.
Years. Yeah. No, it's so quick. I was going to talk a little bit more about The Factory this week, but I think I'm going to save that next week to kind of set the vibe for what Edie is coming mm-hmm. into. So, yes, we didn't quite need the tissues yet.
I did have a moment.
Yeah. The loss of Minty is really, really yeah. devastating. Next week, join us for the rise and fall of the beautiful Edie Sedgwick. For any photos related to today's episode, please go to our Instagram.
You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at AL2KPodcast.
Like us on Facebook at Always the Last to Know Podcast.
If you have any questions, please email us at AL2KPodcast@gmail.com.
Please share, rate, and review us on your podcast listening app of choice.
Join our Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/AL2KPodcast or click the link in our bio on social media.
Thanks for listening.